You are Locked On Pacers, your daily Indiana Pacers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Pacers fans, it is August, which means it's about to be football time and it's the doldrums of the basketball offseason. But that does not mean we are stopping over here at Locked On Pacers. As always, I'm one of the co-hosts, Tony East, and on the other line, who I just saw air drumming in a fun video this week, my co-host, Adam Friedman. Adam, how are you and your air drumming skills?
Pretty good. I thought that video was funny. I thought your comment was really funny, too.
I laughed really hard at that. That was great.
Yeah, I didn't mind that video. I don't like my face being on social media that much, but that video I didn't mind. It's kind of funny. It was a funny video, I thought.
Hi, Marina, if you're sitting in the background listening.
She walked out of the room a little while ago. So it's just you and me, Tony. You and me here and our whole Locked On Pacers audience.
Locked On Pacers and the Elements today. So being the first August show, I did just say kind of the doldrums of the offseason, but we had a kind of busy news week, which was surprising. I don't really know where to start, so we'll do player movement first, and then we'll do the big Nate McMillan news at the end because we kind of already talked about it.
Let's do that.
We'll start with the addition. If you'll recall, they added Elijah Stewart earlier in the summer on this addition or Exhibit 10 contract, which means he can get converted to a two-way. So I kind of penciled in that he was going to get the second two-way just because he seemed like the only guy they were considering. But out of nowhere, we'll talk about that out of nowhere in a second. But out of nowhere, they brought in C.J. Wilcox, who was on their summer league team on a two-way contract. And C.J. Wilcox was a first-round pick in 2014, so that's not the worst thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, he also doesn't have a ton of NBA experience. Will you explain? Well, he has like a minimal – will you explain how he qualifies, even though he has played three seasons, real quick?
I interpreted that incorrectly. So because the phrasing is more than three, picture it like this. If a rookie plays in one game, he doesn't have 1 year of experience, right? He's still a rookie the whole season. So your years of service ticker doesn't go up till the end of the season. So he'll be on exactly 3 years of service the whole season. So you have to four till the season ends. So the rule for 2A contracts is you can't have more than 3 years of service, but he has exactly three seasons because he didn't step on an NBA court last year because he was injured. So okay, that's how they're legally able to do it.
Okay, so that makes sense, I guess.
Let's talk about C.J. Wilcox, though, instead of some technicality.
I just want to clarify that because I think when I saw you throw that out, and I think I understood, but I wanted the audience to understand.
Yeah,
there is some confusion there.
I had to hit up Jeff Siegel, who's the guy for cap stuff. By the way, if you don't follow him at JG Siegel, you are missing out. He is a brilliant guy. He just started writing for Forbes about the salary cap. Dude is smart. Wilcox drafted 28th in 2014. 2 years with the Clippers that were kind of underwhelming, but he didn't get a chance to play a lot because those teams played like eight guys, 35 minutes a game, making excuses kind of. But he just didn't show a lot. Went to the Magic for his third year. Didn't show a lot there. He's only played in 66 games his whole career over 3 years, so he hasn't shown much. But last year he got a two-way with Portland, but he got hurt, and then Portland doesn't have a G League affiliate, so he played for the Santa Cruz Warriors when he got back, and then Portland was making a playoff push, so they didn't want to play him. So thank God they didn't put him on the court because that made him eligible for a two-way again. And after he played decently, I would say, for the Pacers Summer League team, he got the two-way call-up.
Yeah. What's surprising about his signing is I don't think he was the most impressive player of guys available for two-way contracts during summer league. Right?
Oh, I'm with you there. I think iPacers blog, Derek would agree with this too, that Ben Moore was the most impressive guy that I thought would get it too. Yeah.
Yeah, so it makes me wonder, one, if Ben Moore thinks he can make a team next year. Maybe he's looking for an opportunity to do that. You know what I mean? Because, right, you can sign a two-way contract anytime. So maybe Ben Moore didn't want to settle for the two-way today because maybe he thinks he can get on to the 13th or 14th or 15th spot on a roster. Who knows? That could be the reasoning behind it. But like you said, he was decent in summer league. He was probably the second best guy that would qualify for a two-way contract that wasn't like Sumner, Poitras, or the rookies, right?
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree with that. Yeah, absolutely.
So it makes sense if they couldn't, maybe they couldn't get Ben Moore. We don't actually know the weeds of it. So if he couldn't get Ben Moore, this makes sense. I don't know why they committed to the two-way contract so early.
I know. Well, I have theories.
All right. What are your theories?
Well, I was going to leapfrog off your summer league thing first. He only played like 16 minutes a game, but you could tell he had the NBA experience because he just didn't turn the ball over and like try to do too much. You know, I think that's kind of a staple of a younger dude. He only averaged 0.4 turnovers a game. Meanwhile, Aaron Holiday was over 5. TJ Leaf and Poitras were almost at 2. Sumner was at 3. Like, you could just tell he was more poised than a basketball player on the summer league court.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And I think him being hurt last year and not getting a ton of experience too, maybe he gets to play more minutes with the summer league roster. I guess at shooting guard, I don't really know if he'll even get it. Like, even if they're going to need like 2 guys to go down before he gets a shot, but he'll get a ton of experience, I guess, in the G League, which should help him.
Well, you just nailed one of my in the weeds things that I was going to talk about. So Tyreke Evans is pretty injury prone, right? We've talked about that on the show before. So yeah, I think if you're looking at it like it's a shooting guard thing, he could be, you know, pretty like he's probably as good as you're going to get of like a stopgap when Tyreke is hurt shooting guard on 2A to put in the game, right? Just to soak up minutes.
Yeah, but my thought is if Tyreke gets hurt, you probably somehow shift Joseph into the 2 guard and then Holiday the point guard. Like there's
maybe
I'm not sure what. I think Wilcox is cut off still. You need both. You need 2 guards to get up before Wilcox makes the jump.
That's fair. That might be the case. That's what because I was thinking at first, though, when I saw it. I was like, okay, you know, if you – maybe, you know, in Holiday's rookie, you know, he could not be anything. Like, Wilcox might be more impactful than him. Who knows? I agree with you that I'd rather probably play Holiday and let him develop if that scenario existed. But, I mean, it's just like it could be – the most positive scenario that could have gotten on a 2-way given Tyreke's injury problems.
Yeah, plus we don't know where he ranks above Sumner, too. Isn't Sumner going to play guard position, too? I mean, I guess the idea probably is that he was probably the best guy they thought that he could get, and that's where they got him for. You know what I mean? You don't really, you don't worry about is it a guard, is it a fourth, whatever, when you're that low in the roster. You just worry about, hey, who's the best guy out there that we think could become a rotation player, you know, could play some minutes for us in a playoff game.
Can he not suck on the wing? Okay, great. That's a 2-way contract. You know? And I think he can not suck on the wing.
Yeah, and you're looking for a guy who could possibly become a bench role player. That's sort of like you're probably the peak of these G League guys. You know, I guess Sumner is a difference because he got hurt and there's could be something, he could become something. But mainly it's can this guy eventually become, you know, the 9th or 10th guy on our team and play some minutes in the regular season, provide us some wins and not screw things up.
Yep, and I think Wilcox has a chance to do that. And this is just a joke, but I thought I'd include it in there. CJ Wilcox spent a season with the Orlando Magic, and we know how good the Pacers are at making former Magic players into good basketball players.
That's like, what, the 3rd, 4th time you made that joke this offseason?
I love that joke, Adam. It's my favorite. So that's obviously he's going to be great. But I think it's fine for what it is. And my other in-the-weeds thing I want to talk about with this involves Ben Moore, too, who we were just talking about. Because they still have that last open roster spot, you know, they like to bring in a guy on a non-guaranteed deal there so they can waive somebody if they want to, you know, add a guy in the buyout market. I think Ben Moore is even more likely to get it now than he was before this signing.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, he played so well. I mean, you know, like I say, it wasn't like fantastic, but he played really well and summer league enough that he could get looks from other teams is what I'm kind of thinking. Yeah. He might see an opportunity where he actually has a shot at making the team or feels he's a better shot, and that could be sort of the difference, but he's been in the rotation now, what, a year? Oh, is it now going into year 2? So he has some familiarity around here. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I guess if you look at the small forward spot or the 4 spot, they are sort of, they don't have like that 3rd guy to be the 4, right? Or 3 or 4. They sort of be Tyreke Evans or be Vic Plank. So there would be a possibility that he could get kind of left roster spot and then maybe McDermott gets hurt or Bojan gets hurt and gets some opportunity to play some minutes at least.
Yeah, if Leaf stinks, he could fill in an option as a backup 4 for injury. They're trying to make him play the 3 a little bit, which you can never have too many wings. So I think there's a better chance that he gets that spot now, which would be good for him. And I like having a prove a deal for a guy like him who works hard. So maybe this CJ Wilcox signing does have another layer.
Yeah, and he would probably more of get the Poitras deal, probably.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Some, like it would probably actually more like the Wilkins deal where
probably. That's what
he meant. A January date guarantee, something like that. It might be a 2-year. Well, you only do 1 year just if you're doing half partial guarantee at midpoint. So,
yep,
be a 1-year contract probably.
Yep, and that'd be good. I think he could do well on that. So, I'm hopeful that something like that happens. They always get creative with their last slot. So who knows? They signed Wilkins pretty early on in free agency last year, though. So, not a clue what the plan is. But that's my guess now is that they gave Wilcox a 2-way and plan on giving Ben Moore a non-guaranteed 1-year deal.
Yeah, that makes sense, and like. like I said, it's right now we're just sort of trying to read the tea leaves. We're sort of trying to figure out what one move means to the other moves. And ultimately, though, these guys are playing, like I said, for the last roster spots or backup minutes. So I'm not sure it's
going to make a huge difference. I bet Wilcox and Moore combined for about 50 minutes total this season. So we are really down in the nitty gritty with this.
What, Moore got 8 last year, right?
Nine.
Oh, man, I missed by one. I knew it was under 10.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, that's what we're talking about in terms of, I mean, barring some major injuries to multiple players, basically.
Well, yeah, Poitras played some okay minutes on his, but either anyway.
Yeah, but it's still, it's banging on like a guy tearing his ACL and then them not trying to get a replacement for that guy and banging on Moore to replace him. That's basically what this is.
Exactly. There was another Pacers roster move, sort of.
Third player to China,
which just is kind of hilarious at this point. Actually, one more CJ Wilcox thing. He's been just an okay three-point shooter in the NBA, only 33%. But in college, he had two seasons over 40%. So maybe there's hope he's an okay shooter. Okay, moving on.
Yes. We'll see.
Third player in China, Trevor Booker, according to Alex Kennedy, the Mighty Hoopsite reporter. I closed the tweet on accident. I went to read it and I accidentally closed it. Trevor Booker is close to signing a deal with the Zhangji Brave Dragons in China. That would be the third Pacer to go overseas with Joe Young and Al Jefferson. There's not a ton to that. I think Booker's in an awkward spot because he's probably NBA talent, but no bad team wants Trevor Booker because he's not going to play and he's not like a quality vet, quote unquote, but no good team wants him because he can't really play him in the playoffs and there's better guys available for the minimum. So he's just in a tough spot. So China it is.
Yeah. You said before the start of the show, it's like three of the Pacers top 12 are in China now. And then one guy who played in the playoffs, but I'm not sure Booker should have played in the playoffs. I mean,
probably shouldn't have.
Yeah, they should have shrinked the rotation to 8, to be honest. I mean, yeah. they might have won the series if they had.
I mean, how many minutes did he even play total in the playoffs?
I don't know, but I remember a couple.
I only said that because I know he did, but I don't know how much he did. He played.
There were a couple of third quarters where I thought they kind of lost it with him.
64 minutes over 7 games. So that's crazy, but
that's like 9 minutes game. So that's probably beginning of second quarters and end of third quarters.
Yeah, He shot well. To be fair. But, yeah, if he's playing, things have gone interesting.
Well, it's because they really never had that ninth guy. That was a real problem all year. And that's what they sort of solidified this offseason with. Kashi really bringing O'Quinn was sort of like that was the 10th guy. But it was sort of solidifying that if we can't rely on our ninth guy, we have another guy we could probably rely on.
Right. So. Yeah, they chose him over GR3 last year in the playoffs, which was interesting.
Yeah, I think GR3 is still hurt most of the
time. Yeah, I do too.
I think he may re-aggravate. I don't know what it was. I think because they're right. The original plan would be GR3 at the ninth man, and then Jefferson maybe at the ninth man. But Jefferson just couldn't play, so then they had to rely on Booker. They brought in March. So it's never a good sign when you bring in a guy on a team who made the playoffs and didn't want him, basically.
So the Zhangji Brave Dragons. You know who was on their team last year?
No idea.
Louis Scola.
Nice. Lots of guys making money in China. Good for them.
Joe Young got $1.3 million, which is right around what his minimum would have been here. Guaranteed money. So good for him, man. That's great stuff.
And he'll probably get the dominant there. I mean, he'll probably want to.
Oh, absolutely. And
the best.
The reason a lot of them pick China over Europe, too, is because the European League bleeds into April or like March and April, but China ends before March, right? So like a team that needs a guy for the playoff stretch can sign them and they can play in the playoffs. So
yeah,
it is appealing.
Well, and it's a nice way, especially when, I mean, I don't know for Joe Young is probably different than Jefferson, but you can, as a young player, one, you can go there and make a buck real quick and try to kind of just work on your game. With Jefferson, it's a way to sort of build his brand globally in some sense. And maybe
Jefferson push himself as a when he visited. So.
Well, and Jefferson, it was, he wanted an opportunity to really play and he knew he could play in China. Right. It's a way to kind of, we think he's going to be a coach someday. It's kind of a way to build that credentials by working with other players. Maybe he got some opportunity to sort of like help out in that sense as a coach. But for Joe Young, it's a way for him to make some more money, which is good for a guy who's 26 years old. He's made probably a few million dollars, but it's
just had nice a kid to make too. A
million more.
Just had that kid.
Yeah, it's nice to make a few million more. It never hurts.
Yep. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of China on the Pacers. So maybe we'll keep up with the Chinese League on the pod this summer.
Yeah, maybe probably not. Maybe when they come back in April, we'll talk about them.
All right, so the big one, which kind of is amazing because we literally talked about it for like 15 minutes on the show last week. We went on and on about contract extensions, and then Nate McMillan got his contract extension. We'll never know the money because it's so hard to find coaching salaries. But he got a 2-year extension, so now his deal is 3 years, including this one. So, yeah, it's interesting. It runs right through Vic. I don't really know if there's a reasoning for that or if it's just how it is. But yeah, congrats to Nate. I mean, he did good last year.
Yeah. So most coaches will not coach on a on a lame duck year. I mean, it's just like a thing in sports is a coach will not go into his last year without a long-term deal in place unless he like is basically knows he won't get any other shot at a coaching job, and then he might do it to try to prove himself. I mean, that happened with the Colts with Chuck Pagano 1 year. But most coaches won't, so that's why they signed him extension. The 2 years, basically, like you said, time up with Vic because he'll have 1 year left on Vic's last season, which means building for extension that year. I don't know. It makes sense. We've talked about it last podcast. There isn't really anybody better out there, and right. I'm not – with a coach, it's hard because you can't just – like if a guy becomes available, you can't just fire a coach and then interview the guy because you still might not get him. It's sort of you're in this gray area, and if they keep playing well, I don't see a reason to get rid of him. You know, barring they like, I mean, like it's hard to kind of get rid of a coach that gets to the playoffs every year. It's hard to say no to that, especially a guy who has a relationship he's worked with Pritchard in the past. And honestly, at the end of the day, it's about the players. And if he can develop Miles Turner, he'll earn another contract.
This guy's probably one of the 15 best NBA coaches in the entire world. You got to keep that guy.
Probably had a top 10 season last year. He probably was in the top 10 last year.
You got to keep that guy. You deserve to keep that guy. So, yeah, it's, we kind of talked about it last week. We're like, in theory, you'd want to keep it shorter if you'd like to secure a better guy maybe in a future summers. But, you know, maybe Nate's not receptive to that, and you want to keep him. So it is what it is. And I'm really happy he's back.
Yeah, and
I know our tone has been otherwise, but –
I think sometimes we don't give him enough credit, too, for some of the play calling they had last year worked out really well. Go ahead, sorry.
Every time we talk about him, we talk about who his great replacement could be. So, that automatically comes off in a negative connotation, you know?
I think a big thing,
our chemistry sucks today, Adam.
Go ahead, Tony. Finish your point.
When we're comparing him to, Mike Budenholzer, it's not like we're like, oh, Nate sucks. It's like, Bud's amazing to me. So I get that it's like weird that we're praising this after our discussions of it this summer, but it's a different scope of viewing now, you know?
Yeah, and I think a big thing that's overlooked about him is last year was the Pacers came into the year. We both thought they were going to try to score 140 a game and run this super fast pace, and pretty much they made a change November range. I mean, pretty soon, and they just flipped the script and basically decided to change their roster. I think they were 21-19 at one point, and they decided they were like, we're going to slow it down a little bit. We're going to play faster at certain paces, but we were going to play more D. And that's a big credit to him to recognize the players they had, mm-hmm. the way they could actually succeed versus the way they were playing so fast, and they weren't really playing that well. And he kind of recognized that, and that's kind of an adjustment that I think has been overlooked. You know, we talk about he's not – sometimes doesn't make the in-game adjustments, but he made the big picture adjustment that really helped to kind of propel this team, especially in that – was it January they went 10-5 or was that February? That month they had a great month.
It was – or was it before Collison's injury? I can't remember.
Whatever it was, at one point they were 21-19, basically on the same pace as last year's team, and then they ran him ahead in the second half of the season. Yeah. And so that's a huge credit to him for sort of figuring that out, finding the right balance of pace – and stuff, pace and how to play defense. And that will help going into this year because they can kind of – now they kind of know what to run, and now it's sort of fixing other things now.
Yeah, he did a great job with that, with the pace change. And it kind of coincided with, Bojan was kind of struggling, and it really hurt. Like, the team running couldn't work as well. They just had less spacing. So it worked out really well, and they kept with the transition. It almost got them to the second round of the playoffs. So.
Well, it was also playing Joseph more at the end of games. And it was the understanding of, he understood that Vic was a really good isolation one-on-one player too at some point, and that helped kind of the idea that you didn't need to run up and down to get Vic open for shots. You could just sort of slow it down and spread out the floor and let him do his thing.
Yeah. It was the perfect transitions. He even had Domas in at the right time sometimes in a game when I needed that extra bit of passing and stuff at center.
He wasn't afraid to put Turner or put Collison on the bench, which is a credit for a guy who did not go to the starts end of games.
Basically. Even Lance a few times was in over Bojan.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of played the hot hand. He played it well for a lot of games. If you think of the Vic should really get hurt, which you could say that could be because he overran Vic for a little while, but I'm not sure Vic knows anything but 110% half the time. if you do that, the team probably won 50 games, so that's a huge bump. And, I think there's just some things he deserves credit for that I understand on the really minuscule things we get mad at, but overall, it was a really good year for him coaching-wise. He deserves this.
What do you mean about Vic always going 110%? He's only scoring 54 points in these random summer leagues.
Yeah, and he's trying. He's schooling kids in his part tutor basketball camp.
That was
and
fun.
He's doing all this random stuff. I mean, I don't think he knows anything else, really.
Yeah, but I'm with you on this. And the Nate extension is what it is. I think it'll be a good move for the organization overall. I get why people are trepid, but people saying like it's only one good year. I think you're really understating how hard it was to go 42-40 with the 2016-17 team. That literally hated each other too.
Yeah, I mean, and he's also shown this ability to be a different coach than he was in Portland. The big problem with him was always that he was like a drill sergeant, that he was on these guys and like wasn't really a player's coach. And I'm not sure he's a player's coach, but it seems like the players and him have a good respect for each other currently. I don't know. I could easily go away because that changes all the time in a single season. I mean, but it seems like there's a good relationship right now between the team and him, which is always what you want in your coach.
People are calling the 42-40 season unimpressive in my mentions. Like Kevin Serafin, LaVoy Allen, and Monte Ellis weren't all in that rotation.
And Paul George missed, I think, 3 weeks of the season.
Yeah.
With a leg injury. He didn't try until, the last 25 games where he really started to actually like, oh, this guy's the top 10 player at this point. Before that, he was like lazily.
Go to the Pacers franchise index on Basketball Reference. The guy who led that team in win shares that year was Jeff Teague, and he got him to 42 wins. Insane.
Yeah.
I think that's very impressive.
People forget that Paul George basically walked around like a ghost until February. I mean, he was fine. He was putting up 20 games. But this is a guy who, when he turned it on the last 25 games, was scoring like 30 or 40 every night and actually showed that he was like trying to be an All-NBA player. Because it's like at some point he thought he was going to LA, or like he realized, oh, I should make the All-NBA team so I can get this $220 million contract. And he like didn't realize that in December, but he realized that in February and it was too late.
Rodney Stuckey played 700 minutes that year. Aaron Brooks played 900 minutes that year. That team was bad.
Yeah, the team was bad, and they made the playoffs, and they actually gave the Cavs a decent run for their money for a couple games.
Yeah, they almost won two of the games. So,
and a Cavs team that was – that year, I thought that year was actually really good. By getting
they were.
Beaten five. They were really good.
Pay more credit for that year. We're going to do a cool topic in about 2 minutes, but Adam wants to share a thought. I want to do the blurb anyway. I don't know. I thought we talked about this last week. I'm not sure. J.J. Redick. We didn't? We did not?
We didn't. We definitely didn't. We texted about it, but we forgot to talk about it. That's pretty sure.
So J.J. Redick on his own pod, The Ringer has the J.J. Redick pod. It's actually really cool. You never listen to it. But he said that he was close to signing with Indy, like a couple hours away. He was talking to McMillan. And then Philly upped their offer, and he went there. That's pretty interesting. I think the timing of it's interesting. I tweeted a big long thread about when I think it happened and stuff. All for me it shows is that they really were going after that shooter in free agency.
Yeah. All right. Can I?
I would like you to do your blurb. Yeah.
All right. So first, I'm gonna cuss. So get ready for it. I know. So J.J. Redick saying he's gonna sign with the Pacers was bullshit. It was really was. I mean, I listened to his podcast. First, he trashed Indiana versus NBA City. He basically went to the Pacers to get an offer to re-sign with Philly. It wasn't like he says he was hours away, but he knew Philly was going to match him probably. I mean, he probably had like I would say 80-20 inkling. Like, it wasn't like he was like, oh, he was wanting to be in Indiana. He was going to go. No, he went to Indiana, got an offer because he knew if he didn't get an offer, he wouldn't be able to get one from Philly. He knew he had to go out and get one because that's what you had to do this offseason because there wasn't a ton of cap space.
Possibly.
It makes sense why the Pacers went after him, but ultimately he was really never coming here. He never probably wanted to come here. He was just doing it because he needed to get the offer to get Philly to match. And that's what he was doing. To say he almost signed here is kind of him probably trying to make up for the fact that he made fun Indiana podcast, got destroyed on Twitter or whatever for being kind of mean to the city, which is fine. He has his own opinion, whatever. Not a big deal. Like I said, if he wants to trash Indianapolis, he can. But it was kind of his way of probably trying to bring those people back. And it's sort of BS because I don't think he ever wanted to be here. I don't think he really ever thought he'd actually be here. He just thought he had to get somebody offer him something so he would get Philly's attention.
Yeah, I wonder what his agent – I bet his agent's very happy with the Pacers. I'm trying to find who it is, but I am struggling to figure out who his agent is.
Yeah, and it makes sense. But, like, it makes sense why he did it. But he didn't want to be here. He's a guy who lives in Brooklyn. Philly is – like an hour and a half train ride from Brooklyn. So it's a pretty close to there. He didn't want to end up in Indianapolis. He just wanted to make sure he got his $12 million, basically.
That might be true. I have another theory too, but I'm checking out his agent's clients to see if there's any Pacers on this team. No. So his agent is the guy who represents Julius Randle, who a lot of people wanted here this summer. Other than that, not a ton of guys with any Pacers connections. My theory is this. I tweeted about this. I think what happened is Philly offered something like the MLE value, and the Pacers offered like 2 for 15. And he's like, hey, I got more money. And then Philly upped it when they learned LeBron was definitely not coming, and they knew they'd have a little more space. And they still did a 1 year, so they could open up space next year. And he knows he can recuperate the money. But I think I'm betting that the Pacers offered the year, so he would come if they actually wanted him.
I bet he didn't get a 2 year. I bet he got the same offer Tyreke Evans got.
I will. Oh no! I don't agree. I think that they were deciding between Redick and McDermott. And then when Redick went away, they immediately flipped to McDermott.
But I still think their plan all along was to sign one guy for 12 and another guy for 6. I understand that maybe they're offering a little more than that, but I think their plan was to get two guys. But I understand they wouldn't have got McDermott and maybe not got Evans, but I think the idea was they were slotting, they were going to get one guy for 12 year and one guy for 6 and try to not lock up this 12 guy for multiple years and one that cast base 12. And the Pacers also probably want the cast
exactly. Base so offer well. JJ Redick 2 for about 7 and then get Tyreke for 12.
Yeah, but then why would Philly come out with 12? That's a lot more than...
So they could get him for a one-year deal.
Yeah, but I'm thinking the Pacers offer. Maybe they offer 12. Maybe that's where maybe they offer 10. But I think they offered him a one-year deal. I don't think they offered Redick 2 years.
I bet they offered 2, and that was what it was. It was just guaranteed money for him.
I don't think it was because the Pacers don't.
I mean, we don't have all the details. That's just a personal theory. But
yeah, I think I disagree. Like, I don't know. I don't think he. But
I know. I do like your theory that it was a leverage play. I mean, it worked. It worked.
Yeah, it was a complete leverage play.
Whatever it was, it worked. And I should have. Oh yeah. I'm looking at it right now. I'm dumb. Yeah, no other Sixers clients for his agent. But they used to have Sergio Rodriguez, who played for the Sixers and his.
Also, I think the Pacers would have signed both him and McDermott because they just want shooters, right? I mean, that's what they're doing.
Yeah, thing. That's – well, I think that –
they might have signed both still, to be honest.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know if they would have signed both. But well, I think the timing makes sense too because he said that they upped their offer at 5, which would have been on July 30th. You know, they go out. They meet with – or June 30th. They go out to meet with LeBron. They realize he's not coming, so they officially offer it to Redick. He signs it the next day. Meanwhile, McDermott officially agrees to the deal 3 hours after that deadline. I put in air quotes. I don't know. I just think the timing makes a ton of sense.
See, I think they probably – I'm changing my thought, but I think they probably had Redick for 12 in 1 year and McDermott locked up since June 20th.
Oh, they – no, Adam, they didn't tamper after they made fun of Lakers for doing all that.
Oh, yeah, whatever.
That cracks me up. They announced McDermott before free agency even opens, even though the Pacers are snitching on the Lakers for tampering.
Which is funny because they paid $500,000 to not get Paul George.
I know. It's so funny. Yeah, it's even funnier now. We never made that joke. They tampered and didn't get him.
That's the best. I said
2 minutes for a fun topic, and that didn't happen. But we're going to talk a little bit about – I think we should reference Kalen's piece too. Turner and Sabonis playing together after this break. So, first of all, there's going to be an announcement after this about the show, so stick around. But I don't know if – did Kalen's piece inspire you to discuss this? I don't know.
Yes. Or not. Well, that did – I wrote a little bit about it before on just a lineup, but she went with Lame Death, which just kind of inspired me about this. And it's been – I have a list of topics, and it's just been one that I've had written down for a ton because it's sort of the most important storyline for the Pacers next season, I would say.
We completely missed one of our topics in the first half, Adam, but that's okay. We can talk about it some other time.
But it wasn't important.
It's not important. It's not actual news. It's opinions. So Sabonis and Turner playing together is the topic here. Kalen's piece was really good. It was about their movements and – their locations on the court and how they can maximize having both of them out there by having them being opposites in movement and spacing, basically like don't have them be clogging up the same areas. It was really good and in depth, and I really enjoyed it. And it obviously makes you think about that too, being on the court together. So we're digging through the archives into last year's stats and projecting how that might work this year.
Yeah. And I mean, Caitlin's piece, everyone should go read that. It's really good.
Oh, it's so good. So good.
It was really good. So, like, my first kind of thought of this whole thing is if the Pacers are going to put Sabonis back at power forward, they're essentially putting him back to where Oklahoma City wanted to play him because they wanted to play him next to Steven Adams, I think was kind of maybe the thought. And that's kind of been, I guess, universally thought now, at least among Pacer world, that that's what kind of harmed Sabonis, right? Was the fact they didn't let him play center, they didn't let him flourish as a center, and that's what kind of allowed this growth this year.
Yeah.
But they're also – there's my thought is Steven Adams is just the old school traditional center, right? He is like as Rudy Gobert, as, I mean, like, as close as you can get to, like, the Dwight Howard Center today, right?
Yep.
See, man, I mean, and while Miles Turner is sort of, he's the modern center, right? He's to stretch the court, shoot threes. He's kind of not a great rebounder. He's not going to bully you down low. Maybe he will this year. Maybe he'll develop that skill. But Turner theoretically could play more of a power forward spot except on D, right? But on the offensive end, you could play Sabonis at center, let him set all the picks and roll everything, and just have Turner moving around, three-point shooter. I don't know how much of a sharpshooter he is. You know, we more see him on the pick and pop where he has a lot of time to pull up on a shot. But there is some kind of evidence, at least when we watch him later, that he could, at least at the worst, kind of be just in the corner spot of three-point shooter if he can develop kind of his three-point shot into like the 38% range.
Yeah, and exactly. And, you know, we saw him shoot well from the corners last year. He works well out of the pick and pop from the slots. And that's really where he thrives. But at the same time, Sabonis is a substantially better screener. And that creates a lot of space for the ball handler. That creates a lot of space for Sabonis. And in theory, that could open up the corners because help has to come when the defense breaks down defending the pick and roll. And Caitlin kind of touched on that too. So you could create some openings using them in that way. And I like that idea. And I can't remember who played the four on this team perfectly, so I just need to look it up. But when Thon Maker in Milwaukee was at his best in 2016-17 was when all they had him do was stay in the corner and move around the perimeter. And then Jason Kidd started putting him in the post, and he completely stopped being effective. And I think that using him almost in that role would be the best way to use him when Sabonis is also on the court.
Yeah, I think you're right. The thing I worry about a little bit with this is the Pacers clearly want Turner to develop into a traditional center. So I wonder if he's working on that post up, putting him in the post game more, and that sort of destroys this whole thing.
Greg Monroe was the guy I was thinking of sharing the court with Thon there. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they necessarily want him to be a post player more as they want him to develop more post skills just so he's more versatile, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean, right, the biggest issue you would say with Turner too is he has to be able to move without the ball. He's not that great at it.
No, shout out to one of my best friends in college, Ben Jones, here for this one. He said in a text to me a couple weeks ago that, like, sometimes with Turner, it feels like it takes him, like, six movements to do what other players can do in, like, one or two. And that is especially apparent with his movements. You know, he kind of, like, takes a false step when he starts running, and then his arms are kind of not in the right – like, he's not running in stride and just kind of
looks never confident.
Yeah, it's kind of awkward. You can tell when he's confident, too. Like, we can easily see it. And I agree with that sentiment. I think it would help if he would just be more, you know, concise with his movements and cut more with more brevity and stuff. You know, I think those kind of things are things that could really help him with movement.
Well, I mean, that's the huge problem with him in the playoffs was the same kind of thing where he gets the ball sometimes too, even he just doesn't know. Doesn't seem like he knows where his next play is going to be right away.
That's why I love he does too. Yeah.
But when Turner does, it's like, he can be really good. Like I remember that Boston game they won where he got the ball in the post and he knew he was going to score on Marcus Morris. Like he just knew it. He knew he got the ball. He's like, I'm going to score. And he backed him down twice, turned around, banked it off the glass and scored. I mean,
that was that the kind most pumped he was all season.
Yeah. And there's a couple times where he has the ball and goes to the rim. He's the same thing. He's like, I'm going to go right to the rim. Sometimes it's called for an offensive foul on that. But like, it's those kind of plays where he just has to put those together more of. And I don't know how he does that. If it's just a confidence thing or what it is, but if he can just do, like, just be a almost irrational confidence more kind of player, he'd be a better player on the offensive end, at least.
And he'd be a better player with Sabonis, which is both the focus of the section and probably the focus of a lot of the Pacers' scope, because if they can get Vic and those two working together, that solves three of their five starters on their presumably next best team. So it would work really well. And I talked to you about this before. I think a lot of it just comes down to the way the league is now with three-point shooting. So last season, when Turner and Sabonis shared the court, you know, both of those guys can shoot, but when they're on there together, the spacing is kind of more clogged. And the Pacers, as a team, when those two shared the court together, shot 33.8% from deep, and that includes both their shootings. I should pull up individual player stats momentarily. That's just the team. And that's not great. You know, it's harder to create with those two guys out there. You're counting on other people for the three-point creation. But the flip side is where it's kind of more problematic because neither of them can defend the perimeter at all. You know, when you get outside of 10 feet, they're both kind of useless because, you know, Sabonis doesn't really know how, and Turner kind of has the awkward movements. We don't have to beat the drum there. But the other team Go ahead.
So I think Sabonis can develop this skill, actually.
I think he can, too. I hope he can.
I think he can develop the – I mean, he's not going to be amazing on the perimeter defense, but, I mean – I look back, I've said this a bunch of times, but you look back at the against the Cavs in the playoffs, and he was not the worst when he got switched on to LeBron. Like, he could kind of stay in front of him. He didn't foul him a couple of times. Like, he just made LeBron kind of fight, kind of the same way David West used to make LeBron just, like, fight for everything.
Yep.
It's if he could do that more, I mean, I understand it's not going to work in every situation, but basically, if you take out the Warriors and the Rockets, they only have to play four times. These teams, like the – even – even Boston, they're going to kind of stretch it out as much, but they don't have like these world beating 3-point shooters all around their team, just like those two teams have. So like this lineup could easily work if you get enough offense out of it.
Yeah. The other teams, what I shot 39.1% from three, 39.2, excuse me. And that's super good. So that's problematic. And I'm with you on the Sabonis being the one of the two that would be more likely to be the good perimeter defender. And that's also important too, because I think you have to focus on your assets, like what the team would be the best at when those two are on the court together. And Turner's a great rim protector. You don't want to make him not be right by the basket. So having him defend on the perimeter is just wasting one of his skills.
Yeah. And I think what's a bonus too is he didn't shoot the three a lot last year, but if he develops that 3-point shot, I mean, remember Thad shot 32% from three. I mean, if he has to shoot better than that, he's technically a more effective power forward in terms of stretching the floor, theoretically.
So I'm gonna. Me and Adam talked about this before the show, and Adam, I'm ready to recite the stat for you that will make this will make all of you who have never thought about this think differently about the Sabonis and Turner pairing. Adam, are you ready for this?
I am ready for it.
So when Miles and Domas shared the floor last year, the Pacers were a -48 in 545 possessions. However, when those two and Lance Stephenson all shared the floor, they were a -60. So without Lance, those two together were actually a +12.
Yeah,
how about that?
We're looking at the stats. I mean, you look at their best lineup for the most minutes played without Stevenson, with basically 14 games, 24 minutes with Oladipo, Bojan, Joseph, Sabonis, Turner, and it was an effective lineup. It was +8 on the court. It was 45% from three, so that checks your box of being way above 33%. It wasn't a ton of minutes. It was such a small sample size. I don't know if you make a ton out of it, but if you sort of take Stevenson out of the equation, the lineups look a lot better all of a sudden.
Yes.
Just because the added value Sabonis adds to Oladipo's game on offense is a ton. I mean, I think it's underrated. It's almost underrated at this point, but how much Sabonis just setting screens, his handoffs, all the kind of things that got Oladipo, the kind of easy shots he loves, was a lot of it was created by Sabonis at times, and him being on the floor kind of boosted offensive rating by a ton.
Yeah, and here's another one. Lance was -60 with those two. Kojo was -65. That's even worse. And a lot of that's because that lineup just can't shoot threes at all. That's extremely problematic for both spacing and shot creation. So I think if Collison was +5, like they were a positive with those three. So if you can get as many situations as you can with Collison out there with them, I think they could really work better.
Yeah. And my big thing with this lineup is, so the whole NBA, right, we've all decided that the stretching the five shooters is like the whole goal and the best way to win. But the next step to kind of breaking that mold is finding a way to beat that, right? Finding the next evolution of the game. I understand it might still involve some of the stretching and all that, but it's finding this evolution of, can we put 2 6-foot-10 guys on the court who are like just bullies out there? Can they rebound in a way that just destroys teams? You know what I mean? Can they, if you have two of these bigger guys, can they just out rebound people like crazy if they get better at that? And offensive rebounding creates so many extra possessions that like it becomes a positive, essentially, that even though they aren't stopping every three, they are just destroying teams in some ways by so much that it makes up the margins.
They're trying to make you have, I think they're trying to go for the more possessions, you know, on the glass there too. I think that's not
right. I mean, if Sabonis can get bigger, which I think he will, if you look at his dad, I think Sabonis has some more muscle to put on. And yeah, he's getting bigger too. They should be just sort of like, how are you going to out-rebound this team without having two big guys on the court with them? Like, you know what I mean? Who is going to really out-rebound them? Can they create, you know, I don't know what the league average is, but a bunch of extra offensive possessions? And that would help kind of change the fact that if you shoot, you know what I mean? Let's say you only shoot 33% from three, but you have five or six extra threes per game, that could kind of change the whole game.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the way to go. And I think Philly's kind of spearheading this too with the Embiid Saric stuff. I mean, I think it's underrated how tall Dario Saric actually is. I mean, you don't consider him a post player, but
it's a similar lineup though. It's a very similar kind of idea.
6'10", and he can really shoot three. I mean, I don't want to make it that simple because it's not. But like, if Sabonis is a 39% 3-point shooter, like this is an entirely different discussion, and that's where Dario's at. So you know, the Embiid Saric thing's kind of a mold you'd like to look at because those two work really well together.
Yeah, and you wonder if you can put these two guys out, whether you can really, I mean, it'd be about being able to bully Boston around and bully Toronto around, and that's kind of the idea is, can you kind of bully those two teams? And you might be able to, because if they play Jason Tatum at the four, let's say, and Tatum is a great offensive player, but, I mean, he's still kind of a thin kid for, he's not obviously only 20 years old, so he's still small. But then you want, I mean, Sabonis could just throw him around on the glass. Yeah.
Oh, destroy him. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so, and then if Turner can kind of at least be even with Horford, you're winning rebounding battle. Then you force them to play Marcus Morris, and that kind of changes the game because Morris is just not a good offensive player as Tatum.
Yeah.
Or maybe take Brown or whatever it is. But that's sort of the idea is, if can you zag a little bit while incorporating some of the stretch enough to sort of be, oh, the new style is having 2 6'10" guys who can both shoot threes. That's the next move.
Kind of both thing. Shoot, or they can both pass really well, because that just that means they can create, because that's, you know, I think that's the problem with, like I said, with Kojo out there, is less so the shooting and more so there's just no creation. Like, every shot that's created is just someone dribbling around and putting something up. And that
And let's be honest, the most way teams end up kind of becoming one of the better teams in the league is by kind of changing the game to their style. I mean, if you look at even like when the Pistons won, the Pacers did the same thing in the same era, but it was changing the game to, we're going to just slow you down and we're going to beat the hell out of you and we're going to win the rebounding battle with Ben Wallace every time, and we're going to just destroy you at times on just like, you're just going to be exhausted by playing us. Or it was LeBron making everybody change to his efficiency. I mean, it's about changing the game to the way you play, and that's how you sort of become one of the better teams. The Houston's an example of that too. They're sort of trying to change. Their whole thing is, we're just going to shoot 63s a game, it feels like, and that's changing the game to their way. And so that's sort of what the Pacers need to try to do, at least, if they want to sort of make that next step.
Exactly, and it works for other teams. You know, that's the Warriors kind of realized this small ball thing worked for them and just beat it down everybody's throat. So maybe the Pacers can spearhead the 2 6'10" guys. And Nate talked about that in summer league. It's certainly something they want to try.
Yeah, and it might have some rough patches, but maybe, and this year especially is kind of a trier because they always have Thad Young back there as a safety net.
Exactly.
Kind of just playing. Yes. So try it this year. If it works enough, they can then switch to it.
Exactly. They have a lot of options. But hopefully it works, because it's crucial for the future of the team.
If not, one of them will be traded.
Yep. We both know who it's going to be.
Okay, I'm not going to say it. Because I think it could be either one. I mean, honestly, but I think we both know it's going to be, probably.
Yeah, so, I agree. But we
won't. It doesn't work this year. He's the only guy with the windows on his deal. And
so, a little pivot for the show closing here. One is that we were going to talk about the first released over-unders for the league, but we will do that.
Oh, my God, we missed that.
That's what I was saying earlier to you. But we'll do that next week. Maybe they'll get updated by then. Who knows? But it's interesting. Let's just say that. It's interesting.
Yeah, and it's still relevant next week. It's not a big deal.
It'll be relevant all summer. Thank God. So that's something. But the other thing is, we've had a lot of people talking about this to us on Twitter. So we're going to do it. We're going to start the fan shows. The logistics are basically all there. How I kind of want to do is have two or three of you guys on every show, you listeners on. And how we're going to do it is probably a 5-minute segment where you talk about kind of how you became a Pacers fan. I got a great story on Twitter about that. I screenshotted it. And then one topic of your choice. So that will be really fun. Maybe we can get some fun topics on the show. Get a little more voices, get a little more fan experience versus our, you know, I feel like me and you are kind of drifting away from the fan experience sometimes. So
it'll be fun.
It will be really fun. And I think it's always fun to talk to people who listen to the show. But the important part is, we can't do it without you guys being on the show. So if you're interested in being on the show, just let us know by, as we say every episode, tweeting at us on Twitter. Adam is at Friedman Adam 5, FRIEDMAN, Adam spelled like you would guess, 5. I'm at T East NBA. And the podcast is at Locked On Pacers. We'll respond on there too. I try to make sure to stay active on that one as much as I can.
Yeah, I check it every day, so I see.
And I think my direct messaging is open. I'm not sure. I need to change it if it's not. I'll change it right now if it's not.
So, I think mine is. It's like I get requests, and I'll look at them. So
yeah. So just find a way to let us know, and we'd love to have you on. And I think it'll be really cool. So we'll try to do two episodes a week now. One will be like this, where it's just us talking about, you know, the news and the analysis and things that we want to talk about. The other one will be you guys. So I look forward to it. We'll try to have the first one out Wednesday or Thursday. And don't be nervous. It's going to be really fun. I think we're both pretty good at talking to anyone about the team. So it'll be easy for you. It'll be fun.
Yeah, if you come on, be ready to argue with me. I will be yelling and
not go easy on you.
Yeah, be ready to be challenged on whatever it is. But we can do anything. We can talk about – I mean, we can do anything you want to talk about Pacer-wise. It can be this team. If we talk about old team, we can debate, I don't know, old Pacer teams and
– Yeah, all of
you. Anything you got.
All of you who tweeted us and said, do you guys know who Roger Brown is? We're talking to you right now.
Yeah, I mean, let's put it this way. If I have enough prep, I can pretty much learn about anything. But I know a lot about the 90s, 2000 Pacers, and today's Pacers. You know, starting Reggie Miller era, I can probably do. I can hang with anybody. Before that, it gets a little rough. But I'm not sure you want to talk about the 80s because the 80s weren't that great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the fun 80s era, the Chuck Person era.
The 20 and 61 Pacers for like three of those. Like, and they had their five worst records in the 80s. So.
Gosh. But yeah, that'll be really fun and exciting. I'm really pumped to do that. And after our chat, we can talk about what you guys think we can do to make the pod better in person, which is easy. Also, if you're interested, make sure you have a Gmail account just because of the way we record. But that is the end of that. I'm really excited for that. And you'll be able to hear one on Wednesday or Thursday and see how it goes. So yeah, that's our big announcement. I'm excited.
Yeah, sorry. I thought you were finishing the show. Do you want me to say something?
No, I didn't know if you had anything else.
No, I am good.
You're going to write the chat this week, so.
Well, maybe. I took this week off for some writing, so.
Oh, yeah. You're busy. Yes. We'll be on the lookout for content stuff. August is fun. It's where creativity. It's where creative content comes flying out. So.
But really, read that Caitlin Cooper piece on Any Corners.
Yes. Really good. Yes, I will promote the F out of that. That was super good. And I'll promote one piece from 8.9 seconds. Andrew Dissinger, one of our new guys, wrote a really cool piece backed by some historical stats and a psychological study that's trying to prove that Aaron Holiday will be the best of his brothers. And it's really good. So highly recommend it.
I did read that. That was good, too. I did read that.
It was cool.
It was intriguing. That's the thing about the Dolphins. Anything that kind of like, oh, this is different, I just kind of read it then.
Exactly. It was good. But thank you guys for listening. I'm excited for the fan show stuff. So, again, let us know about that. Have a great week, I don't have to say that anymore because we'll be on later in the week. But have a great middle of your week, and we'll see you later.